Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and earned a BA degree in history from Temple University and a master's degree from the Cooperstown Graduate Program for History and Museum Studies. From 1994 through 2008, he served in various leadership positions at the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Greg Harris, the president and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. Greg, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jack. Pleasure to be talking to you about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and maybe we'll talk a little baseball and have some fun this morning.
We will. Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Certainly. I grew up born in Trenton, New Jersey, and grew up outside of Philadelphia. And our family wasn't a big music family, but we were certainly a big sports family. I have two brothers. We played every sport all the time, and my dad was an avid coach, and my mother was a teacher and taught English as a second language to students. And they, it was a great time to be growing up in the 60s and 70s, and there was a lot of fun things around us. I think maybe important to mention that my parents were the first two in their families to graduate from college, and they always instilled in us the importance of education and being part of a community.
Greg, what's the biggest thing Mom taught you, and what's the biggest thing Dad taught you?
Mom taught me to not accept things as they are, and she also taught me how to make a really good marinara sauce for pasta, as an Italian mother could. And I think my dad, what he taught us was to compete, but to compete fair, and also, to get up every morning and go at it every single day. It's something that he did and had a great career, and always answered the bell.
When you got the title of President CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Cleveland Plain Dealer wrote an article. Want to run the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum? Then drop out of college, open a record store, cash out, drive a band across the country, sleep on couches, live on $5 a day, and along the way restore a 57 Chevy, 68 Cadillac, buy an old guitar. We're all unique, Greg, but you are a Hall of Famer when it comes to being unique. What gave you that curiosity and that courage to do all these crazy things?
Well, when you're doing them, you don't think they're crazy. But when you look at them from a distance, I guess when you're doing things and you're establishing what you like and what you're interested in and where you're going, it feels like you're zigzagging a little bit. When I stand here and look back, everything fits together perfectly. I think that the early things with restoring cars while still in high school was a desire to build and create something. And frankly, if I was going to have a car when I was 16 and 17, it was because you built it. It wasn't because somebody was going to buy it and hand you the keys. That was just the our circumstance. And so building those, I think it was the same spirit as dropping out of college and opening up a record store, which incidentally, I was involved with it for about 3 years. My original partner still has it. We celebrated the 30th anniversary of the record exchange this past September, and it was a terrific party, and he's had a wonderful life and ran a great business. For me, always pushing forward, and I think that, we were always hustling. We were, again, building things if you needed them. We were always doing every sort of job you could as a teenager. Like many people, the list is long. From delivering papers and shoveling shoveling sidewalks to lifeguarding and unloading trucks at the local UPS. And just we were constantly busy and constantly working. And it bleeds over into how you look at the bigger world. And when you think of opening up a business or doing something that's a little entrepreneurial, you believe in yourself and you've been successful, so you analyze it and then you go for it. And I've been fortunate to make the right decisions and to be working with the right people along the way. Those were kind of the early years, and then being able to partner.
Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Greg Harris, who was with the National Baseball Hall of Fame from 1994 through 2008. Greg, you would meet with these legendary Hall of Famers and just spend time with them. Which did you treasure spending time with the most?
Boy, it's hard to pick just one, because to achieve what they did in their respective industry in baseball means they had excellence on the field, they had longevity as players, and to have that longevity, there's a time when the physical ability starts to become less, and you have to be smart enough to reinvent yourself and manage to become a different type of pitcher or a different type of hitter. But the other piece is you have to get along with people. And these Hall of Famers are great people, and they're great travelers, so they have a real knack for making those around them feel better and feel great. So to pick one or two Hall of Famers that were the best, it's really difficult to do. I would say that all of them were fantastic, and there's some memories of being with certain ones. Imagine walking around Capitol Hill in Washington with Brooks Robinson, and everybody wants to see Brooks, and Brooks is so accommodating and such a warm, wonderful guy and a heck of a ball player. Meeting with some folks to do a promotion tied to the Department of Defense, and having Bob Feller with you while you do that, who had a storied military career and puts that ahead of baseball any day of the week. And being in the room while he's talking to, four-star generals about his experience and what we're going to do together. Really some wonderful, wonderful memories, and just great people all around. And again, to have a 20-year career in a sport, you really need to travel well. You need to get along with teammates. You need to get along with desk clerks. You need to get along with coaches. You need to get along with trainers. And for our Baseball Hall of Famers, they're a cut above.
In 2007, the inductees were Kel Ripken and the late Tony Gwynn, and Richard Gere came as a guest with his 10-year-old son. And Richard was in awe of all these Hall of Famers. At the same time, these Hall of Famers and their spouses, or lady friends, were in awe of Richard Gere. How do you explain that, Greg?
I think there's mutual admiration for those that are the best in the respective industries. So that's why I think athletes admire actors, musicians, successful business people. There's a level of respect that they've achieved excellence in their chosen profession. And for some, it might be throwing a ball 95 miles an hour or notching 3,000 hits. For others, it could be Academy Awards, and for others, it could be building great businesses and having innovative ideas. So I think there's a respect there, and an acknowledgement of the time and the effort and the hours of practice that go into being great at whatever your profession is.
In 2008, Greg Harris, you start another great chapter in your marvelous life. You join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. Greg, what is rock and roll?
Rock and roll is a very broad term. Everybody defines it as their favorite bands are rock and roll, and those they don't like are not. But really, the way we look at it here at the museum is it's not a specific sound. It's more of an attitude. It's It's a voice that questions authority. It pushes the envelope, and it gives voice to the voiceless. And when you think about that, in each generation there have been bands and individuals that have pushed the envelope, and they become the mainstream later. There was a time when Elvis and Bill Haley were revolutionary, and Chuck Berry was an outsider. They are now very much the norm, and there were bands in the 60s that you could say the same thing about, and there's bands today. The other thing that I think is incredibly important is that rock and roll was never one thing. It was never just four skinny guys with long hair and guitars. It was always diverse. So in the 50s, you can have street corner doo-wop harmony and rip-roaring rockabilly coexisting. And in other variations, in the 60s, this is the same art form that can claim Simon and Garfunkel, beautiful vocal harmonies, like the Everly Brothers, just beautiful vocal harmonies, and...
This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with the president, CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Greg Harris. Greg, when you took me through and treated me like royalty a few Fridays ago, the biggest crowd was around the Elvis exhibit. 39 years after he died, he's still the king. Why?
You know, because he's great is one thing. But the other is he came along at a time when the world was very much in transition, and he became the messenger, the Pied Piper, the shot heard around the world for teen culture, for a voice of change, and for excitement. And he burst on the scene when a lot of the world was listening to Patti Page and the How Much Is That Doggy in the Window. Very, you know, popular stuff. And he came on like a hurricane. And while he didn't invent rock and roll, that origin is years before him. And really, he took rhythm and blues and delivered it to a mass audience in a really powerful way. Very talented. People connected, but they were ready to connect. And it went around the world, and Elvis became such a symbol, I believe, of youth and excitement and energy and danger that people connected with him in a big way. And therefore, on his passing, they lost one of the family. Now, not only did they lose him, but we also kept his music. And so you could hear that and reconnect and rediscover and keep him as part of the family. Very, very different than somebody without that body of work. So, you know, he gets a lot of square footage in the museum because he should. He was a pivot point in the history of rock and roll and really in the history of American culture. And he took and delivered, you know, with the help of Sam Phillips and others, but he took really that earlier R&B and gospel and country and blues and put it all together and just blew it around the world.
500,000 fans a year go through the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Fans make these Hall of Fames. Talk to us, Greg, about the fans that come through.
Absolutely. The fans that come to our museum come from all 50 states and over 100 foreign countries every year. 90% of them are not locals. They come from everywhere. And as museums go, and any sort of attraction goes, we're unusual in that every single visitor that comes through our front door has a favorite song. They have a reservoir of memories connected to those songs and to that music. It might be the song from their wedding. It might be the song that they listened to in high school when their heart was broken. It might be the song that was from the greatest road trip ever or from their freshman year at college. Or it's a band that they went to a concert with their friends. And when they come through our front doors and they hear a little bit of that song or they see a little bit of that artist on exhibit, it immediately connects with those memories. It's incredibly powerful because of that, and there are few places that have that power and connection like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Speaking of changing the world and memories, just a week ago, there was a special on John Lennon's 75th birthday, a musical celebration. The Beatles hit the scene. Ed Sullivan revolutionized the world. Talk about the Beatles.
Sure. So the Beatles are another great example of you need to put in the time. They were terrific writers, terrific performers, but they were already 4 years in and well-established before they hit the shores of America and the Ed Sullivan Show. This didn't happen by accident. They spent days, hours, weeks, months, and years honing their craft, playing multiple shows a day in bars in Hamburg, Germany, in bars in England. And they rehearsed, they practiced, they knew all the standards, they knew all the rock and roll hits, and then they started writing their own songs. Really incredible that Lennon and McCartney were together for so long. But when they hit the shores of America, they had an advance man that came and set up the Ed Sullivan shows. They agreed to do three performances, and when they hit the airwaves for that first performance in 1964, a record audience tuned in. It was over 60 million viewers. It was the largest television audience at that time, and it stayed that way for decades. One of the reasons why they were so big was so many people tuned in. And one of the reasons why so many people tuned in is there weren't that many channels in 1964. So if you were watching TV at home that night, you may have a choice of three or four network channels, and Ed Sullivan was one of them. Well, just about every house was tuned into the Beatles that night, and it created this shared cultural connection among everybody that watched it.
As Ed Sullivan used to say, it was a really big show. The Beatles got into the third class in 1988. In the second class was our own I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Greg Harris, President and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And here's a little bit of Save the Last Dance for Me.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye. Let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me.
Greg, what makes that song so special?
That song is so special for two reasons. One, the Drifters deliver it so well. But underneath it, it's so special because it comes from a place that's incredibly real. In the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, in our Golden Age of Rock and Roll exhibit, there's a photo of the songwriter for Save the Last Dance for Me, Doc Pomus. Next to that photo, there's a little wedding card from his wedding, and I'm going to go back to that. Doc Pomus had polio as a child. He used crutches through his adult life and a wheelchair later on. And when he was at his own wedding reception, he watched his beautiful bride dance with the best man, dance with her brother, dance with her father. And he took that card and he wrote across it, "Save the Last Dance for Me." And then he went and wrote the song. It comes from a real place. Doc Pomus and his co-writer Mort Schumann wrote this song, and it just gets you. The other piece that gets you is all you have to do to say to anybody is those six words, "Save the Last Dance for Me," and they immediately hear the song in their head. And it's one of those songs that connects all of us as passionate music fans and as people, and it immediately transports you to a special place.
10 days ago, you announced the 2016 class. Who got in?
The 2016 class. There were three nominees that had not been on the ballot before, and we elected five artists. So Cheap Trick, Chicago, Deep Purple, NWA, and the great guitarist Steve Miller.
Since Chicago's now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, does that mean that my Cubs will win the World Series in 2016, Greg Harris?
You know, it'd be wonderful how those if those things connected. And Chicago had a long were eligible for a long time, and they were finally nominated and elected to the museum in their first year of eligibility. Maybe it means if the Cubs make the series, they're going to win it. But as you know, Jack, you can't win the World Series unless you win the playoffs. So let's hope, for your sake, for your Cubbies, that that the city of Chicago has a chance to celebrate being out here in Cleveland, Ohio, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Wouldn't it be great if it was the Cubs and the Cleveland Indians in the World Series this year?
We've been hoping for 109 years, Harris. So, okay, April 8th, 2016 is the induction ceremonies at the Barclays Arena in Brooklyn, New York. Tickets are on sale starting in a week at www.rockhall.com. Talk about that induction night, Greg.
Sure. So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, the inductees come, they make a speech just like at the Sports Halls of Fame. But then they go put on guitars and grab drumsticks, and they play. And they play, you know, a couple songs out of their song catalog. And frequently, it's a combination of artists that are there to celebrate them. So when Bill Withers was inducted, who wrote the great songs Ain't No Sunshine, When It Rains, and Use Me, he was inducted by Stevie Wonder. And so Stevie Wonder then performed with a great contemporary artist, John Legend, and Bill Withers, and they did his songs. So there's this wonderful element of the induction ceremony where artists get to play their music and the audience and fans get to hear it.
Speaking of which, for the last 20-plus years, you get to hang with these legends of baseball and now the legends of music. Greg Harris, what's that like?
It's quite special. It's also different when you are on the other side of that rope, and you're responsible for making sure the events go smoothly, making sure the operations of the businesses work well, making sure that that the inductees and guests are all taken care of and logistics work. So there's an element that's very special, and you can't forget that. There's also an element where you want to make sure that you deliver the highest quality value for them, their families, but also for your visitors, your guests, and your donors, that's fitting of places that are emblematic of excellence.
When you think rock and roll, you've got to think about divas. Talk about divas.
You know, in the rock and roll world, right now we're in a great era of these female performers. And what's fun is that a number of them